Sorry, Peggy Randall, the Nation's Associate Publisher for Development, and I'm joined today by John Palatello, the Nation's Literary Editor, as well as Bill Derezowich, a Nation Contributing Writer and two-time National Magazine Award nominee, who will speak with us today about the future of literary criticism. First, we expect this call to last approximately 45 minutes. We'll have some introductions from John, followed by a brief remarks from Bill, and then a Q&A session where we'd very much like to hear from you. For those of you who have called in as well as logged into our web interface, you'll be able to submit comments and questions during the Q&A session via the chat feature, which is located at the bottom of your screen. For those of you who have only called in, we will also be taking your questions and comments over the telephone. I'll provide more details about this right before our Q&A session begins. Everyone but John, Bill, and myself will be muted during the presentation portion of the call, but those of you asking questions over the phone will be live once your call is selected. So now let me turn things over to the Nation's literary editor, John Palatello. John?
Hello, everyone, and I want to thank you for joining us. As Peggy said, my name is John Palatello, and I'm the magazine's literary editor. I've been here since September of 2007, and one of the many things I like about my job and being here at the Nation is being able to work with Bill, who's been writing for the magazine since 2004, and he's written about a variety of subjects, literary theory, science, education, and most often and most recognizably, if you're a regular reader of the magazine, Bill writes a lot about fiction, both in English and in translation. He's most recently written about Mary Gateskill, Marilyn Robinson, Salman Rushdie, and Goethe. And in Bill's writing on fiction, there's often a very deep concern with kind of moral questions and quandaries that novelists and their characters wrestle with, and the stabs that both the characters and the novelists take at achieving some sort of redemption. It's almost as though people are narrating their bewilderment and trying to shine a little light into the darkness. So, Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you, and if you could say a few things about, you know, your writing or how you've gotten to the point where you're at now.
Okay, thanks, John and Peggy and everyone else who's part of the call. I just want to start by saying that I've always really appreciated the opportunity to write for The Nation. You've given me the chance to talk about some really interesting books, and you've given me room to develop my ideas, and it's been a really great place to write. I came to writing criticism kind of sideways. I was an academic for many years. I went to graduate school at Columbia, got a PhD in English, and then taught at Yale for 10 years until just last year. But during that whole time, I was also writing criticism for a popular audience, the New York Times Book Review and other places, and now for The Nation. And to me, what I was trying to do in academia and what I try to do in The Nation is really the same. Even if I've had this career shift, to me it's all part of the same enterprise, which is to try to talk about literature, to try to talk about books in ways that I think are important for the people I'm talking to, that really engage with what I think literature engages in, which is, as you said, John, you know, the most important moral questions, the most important existential dilemmas that face us. The truth is that I was dissatisfied to a large extent in academia, and a lot of my writing about literary criticism and the current state of literary criticism comes out of my experiences in academia. I feel like, this is no secret, I'm hardly the first person to say this, I feel like academic criticism has really gotten away from, it's really turned its back, and in many cases deliberately turned its back on the general reader, or, you know, sometimes people refer to as the common reader, the general reading public, and the truth is not just readers, but writers, too. There used to be a dialogue, there used to be a continuity between what people were doing in academia and what people were doing in the magazines and newspapers and what writers and readers were doing. It was all part of the same conversation. It was all part of the same literary culture. And for a variety of reasons that we can go into, academic criticism has become increasingly specialized and increasingly hermetic, both in terms of its concerns and in terms of its language. And so I always felt pretty alienated from the Literary Academy. I wanted to go to graduate school to learn more about literature, and I wanted to teach, but I never felt very comfortable writing in the kind of idiom that that is the norm, that's the expectation now, and writing for a tiny specialized audience. If anything, the kind of writing I do now for The Nation has more in common with what I did in the classroom, which is not to say that I see my readers as students. I think that would be inappropriate. You know, you address students a certain way. They're young. They're still forming their identities. But the commonality is trying to talk to people, you know, as human beings, right? In a full sort of a sort of humanistic approach that says that literature is connected to everything, should be connected to everything, and should be talked about in a language, in the common language that we use every day, that connects all these things together, not a specialized language. In the piece that I just wrote about literary Darwinism, one of the things that I was criticizing in this new trend is that it's a different form of specialization. You know, now we're going to, instead of talking the language of deconstruction, we're going to talk the language of evolutionary psychology, and think of literature as a kind of scientific artifact. And again, to me, this would isolate literature from the common experiences that it's rooted in and that it speaks to. And this is what I try to do in my own writing. I could say more as an opening statement, or we could get to questions, or John, if you have a response.
No, I think it would be best to get to some questions.
Okay.
Okay, great. We're going to start the Q&A session. Let me just give you the lowdown here one more time. For those of you who have logged into our web interface, you'll be able to submit questions and comments during the Q&A session via the chat feature, and some people have already done that, which is great. For those of you who have only called in, we'll be taking your questions and comments over the phone. If you're interested in asking a question, all you have to do is press the star key on your phone, and you can do that now, and you'll be added to our question queue. If you're selected to ask a question or make a comment, you'll hear a chime tone right before being connected live. We'll also call out the first three digits of your area code, so you'll know that I'm calling on you. Let's see. Once you hear that chime, I'll read the first four digits, three digits of your telephone number, and we'll go from there. And then just please tell us your name and where you're calling from. Please try to keep your questions and comments brief, on topic, and to the point, no longer than a minute or so. If you can continue a bit too long, we'll remind you to move towards wrapping it up. We apologize in advance if we're not able to get to every single question or comment. And finally, we invite you to send us an email at rsvp@thenation.com. If you have any additional questions or comments that we haven't been able to get to today. We also invite you to write to us to let us know how you found the whole conference call experience. So first we're going to take a chat question from Alan Cooper, and his question is, since the state of literary criticism in America will ultimately depend on the state of reading in America, what do the reading habits of college graduates under 35 tell us about imaginative writing for the next several decades? Bill?
Yeah, that's a good question and a big question.
Really good question.
Alan might know that I had a web only one of the pieces in the Short of It column last year about the NEA report that I hear Alan referring to. Maybe he didn't intend to refer to it, but you know there have been these reports, Reading at Risk, and then there was a follow up study, and they chart the decline of serious literary reading among Americans, and especially among young Americans. I tend to to sort of gloom and doom, and I try to resist that, especially because really our sources of information, our sources of data, our modes of data collection about this sort of thing are really pretty sketchy. But it does seem to be the case that there's less and less literary reading. This has to do with attention spans. This has to do with the way people are dividing up their time now and with the way they're reading what they're reading. I mean, books are long, and they take time, and it also takes a training in the kind of reading that books require. In other words, it's not just a matter of time. It's also a matter of being able to sit still long enough to get into a book and to open yourself, to sort of surrender yourself to what a writer is trying to not just tell you, but I would say do to you, because books, you know, they're deliberately manipulative experiences, and I don't mean that in a negative way. So what is the future going to bring? I don't know. I mean, I do think that a lot of people are still reading seriously, and a lot of young people. I mean, some of them were students of mine. Like I said, I think it's easy to be apocalyptic about this. On the other hand, I've just been thinking recently, you know, can the novel really disappear? Wouldn't that be, I mean, isn't that ridiculous? But then I thought, you know, from the beginning of time, as we know, I mean, from the beginning of recorded human history until 100, 150 years ago, the main literary form was poetry. And the idea, I'm sure the idea, if you had told somebody in 1850 that within 150 years poetry would be a highly specialized pursuit that very few people pay attention to, they would have laughed at you. And yet that's the state that we've reached. Most people don't read poetry. Most people can't read poetry. They're not equipped to. Maybe it's not far-fetched to say that in 100 years or less, that will be true of serious fiction as well. What the future of literary criticism will be in that situation is hard to say. I guess I can say that one of the things that I'm trying to do in my own small way is to prevent that from happening, or as much as possible, or slow down the process as much as possible by trying to show people why it's worth reading novels and why novels can give them something that nothing else can. John?
I would add only that there's I think the doom and gloom that accompanies such reports now is heightened by this wave of new technologies that has washed over us over the last 10 to 15 years, you know, various handheld technologies or things you find on your desk like a computer. In many ways, we're still learning how to live with them and understanding how they're really just appliances, but more importantly, they do mediate our relationship to the world. And I think, you know, uncertainty about what those things are doing to our lives is only bound to heighten whatever doom and gloom people see when these reports are published. I mean, I ride the subway to and from work every day, and when I first moved to New York, when I moved to New York in the mid-90s and was riding the subway, a lot of people were reading novels and newspapers, and that's not the case anymore on the subway. I mean, a lot of people listen to music or they play games on their phone. More recently, I've been seeing people reading books on Kindle. There's a lot at play right now, and you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but certain things, certain changes I've noticed do give me cause not for gloom, but for worry.
Yeah.
We have actually a follow-up question from Alan. Alan Cooper, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Alan submitted that question, Bill. So, follow-up?
A few thoughts, yes. I just finished a semester. I'm also a college teacher, and I just finished a semester in which things have changed enormously. Students are in class with their laptops. They're all electronically oriented. They don't even feel at home with print, and I just finished a course in which I had them read for at the beginning of the course both of the Homeric epics, how do I do that and make sure that they read it? And the answer is I require them to hand in index cards in which they have questions on the reading for each night. It's a very laborious process, but they have to ask based upon the text. It forces them to read the text, and that gets discussions going in the class. What I'm saying is that it's an enormous burden for teachers to get around the electronic stuff. By the end of the term, students were saying that they were really surprised that they had done so much reading, active reading, and I think it's going to be a real task, but one worth getting involved in. Anyway, I thank you for considering. I wasn't trying to be a purveyor of doom and gloom. I think that there is hope that the students want to somehow be convinced that it's worthwhile opening a book and making it theirs, and I encourage them to write the questions in the margins, to mark up the book, to make it their own. But it's a difficulty. And I think it's worth it.
Alan, you have a couple more good questions that I hope we'll get to as well.
Okay.
We're going to take another telephone call. This one is from area code 915. Area code 915, are you there? Hello, 915? Nope.
I'm there.
Oh, are you there? Are you there? Hello? Area code 915? Nope, I'm going to try somebody else. Hold on. This is area code 412. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, I'm calling from Pittsburgh. My name is Keith McDuffie.
Hi,
can
Keith,
you hear me?
Hi, Keith.
Yeah.
We can hear you, yes.
Good. Okay, well, I was about to ask the question that was asked, and so I'd like to shift the I was an academic for 40 years, 42 years. I'm now retired, happily retired, and I saw the change come over literary studies, beginning with what I studied in college, close reading and the whole new criticism bit, and then change through all the various theories. And now, fortunately, I got out soon enough to avoid the Darwinism. I thought the article by Bill was tremendous, and at the end, particularly, I just stood up and cheered. What I'd like to ask is, now that universities are in deep, deep financial do, and the humanities have been sort of fading away anyway in the eyes of the dean, what do you see as the future for academia? Is there a way that things can be changed? My department, Hispanic department at Pitt, which was pretty well known, became basically cultural studies, and I guess I wonder how we find our way back out of that to literary studies. What's that?
Look, I tore my hair out about these questions for the whole time I was in academia, and I still do, because I still care deeply about what goes on there. And I've been writing about this. I wish I had a good answer for you. I mean, I can tell you what I think we need. I think we need to return to the kind of literary studies that you're talking about, a kind of humanistic understanding of what literature is about. I would love to see universities remember what's special about the humanities, why they need to be supported, why they should be central to a college education, because kids learn, and it's right that they learn a lot of maybe I shouldn't say practical skills, but analytic and rhetorical skills that will help them in practical ways. They learn a lot of specific practical subjects, right? Economics, biology, whatever it is. And that's all great, and that's as it should be, but the role of the humanities, it seems to me, in a student's life and in anyone's life, is to pose the big questions, is to get you to think about what you want to do with all of those skills. What should your life look like? Ultimately, it's a form of liberation. I don't know if that's why the liberal arts are called the liberal arts, but I mean, I do think that they involve a form of liberation from the way we've been conditioned, the paths that have been set out, especially for these kids who are jumping through hoops from, you know, as soon as they can walk.
Right.
And this is their chance to really think about, what do I want to do with my life and what kind of world do I want to live in? I would love to see universities remember that that should be central to the mission of what they do with undergraduates, and to rededicate themselves to supporting the humanities as a result. Whether that will happen, I have to be honest. I'm pretty skeptical that it will, because it doesn't pay, you know. And especially now in a time of financial crisis, I think it's going to get even worse. I'm glad that, you know, it seems like everyone, you know, when our new president talks about higher education, every once in a while he talks about the need for the arts and humanities. I hope that can become more of a thrust of national education policy, and maybe we'll get through to the universities. But right now, they're worried about the bottom line, and English departments don't do that much for the bottom line.
Right. Keep up your good work.
Thank you.
I just want to add something, which is that, and Bill, feel free to chime in. It seems like one issue for the humanities is that many disciplines within the humanities have suffered from a sort of insecurity complex ever since the onset of the Cold War, given the way that federal funding of higher education shifted heavily to the sciences and engineering and all other things. And as a response to that, the humanities tried to be more like the sciences.
Yeah.
In the way they approached their subject matter. And that's where various theories come in, and movements of theories. So I guess the bigger question there is, what does it take for the humanities to get over the insecurity complex? I mean, because it clearly is there. I mean, sciences are more prestigious in terms of publicized accomplishments and very bountiful rewards reaped for the institution in terms of technology transfer or patents or anything like that.
I think that you're right. I would say that there are even larger forces at work. I said this at the end of the Darwinism piece. I think we live in a society that only recognizes one form of knowledge,
right.
Scientific, empirical, quantifiable knowledge. The Cold War may have exacerbated that, but I think it's been true for a long time. I think it's true of modern society in general. I think it's especially true of American society. We recognize very readily that our national strength is built on the sciences. I don't think that's entirely true, but that's what we believe. You know, I have to say, it just occurs to me as you speak that one way that the prestige of this other form of knowledge that we call literary knowledge or humanistic knowledge can be restored is through exactly what we're trying to do in the book and arts section. I mean, I don't think you can get up and talk about it. I don't think you can get up and say it, you know.
Right.
But I think you can show it. I think, in other words, I think, let's say that the problem with the humanities position is related to the fact that it's become, that academic criticism has become so hermetic, right? So it has no place in society as a whole. It doesn't want to have a place in society as a whole. And so there's no sense in society as a whole that this kind of conversation about literature has value. And if you can stage that kind of conversation in public in a way that people recognize its value, feel its value, well, then maybe we can get somewhere.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to argue with that.
Okay.
A follow-up question, chat question, and also I want to remind everybody who's on the phone, if you want to ask a question, all you have to do is press the star key on your keypad on your phone. This question is from Jay Gold, and it's we've covered some of it, but it's related. How much is the situation you described related to it being more difficult to earn a good living as a literary journalist? As did Wilson, Tazen, Fadiman, et cetera. And so would be critics either go into academia and become theoreticians, or they go into some other line of work and don't do criticism at all?
Look, that's absolutely right. I mean, I've had students who want to know how they can do this, and I have to tell them that, you know, it's pretty hard, and you need to find another line of work while you're doing it. I mean, I always, like I said, I did it on the side as an academic, and I don't, I mean, I'm trying to make a living as a writer, but it's not going to be by writing book reviews. And I don't blame the publications because, I mean, as we know, publishing is in crisis, and even before it was in crisis, you know, you could. I think it's worth remembering, though, that most of the great New York critics, Wilson was an exception, but Kazin, Trilling, and Howe were all academics also. I think Clifton Fadiman was at the University of Chicago. I don't know that it was ever really possible to make a living as a literary critic exclusively. I mean, a lot of the best critics have been fiction writers or something else. And I think that while it's true that would-be literary critics go into academia and get lost there, I still think that academia is going to have to be the place. I don't see an alternative. I mean, I don't see the journalism really being able to support the livelihoods of more than a handful of literary critics, the people who work for the Times, maybe the people who work for the New Yorker. I would like to see a return to the time when you could have a Kazin or a Trilling at an English department. And I think that will also be beneficial to the departments, right? I mean, I think it'll help make the case that they're worthy of continued funding and support. So that's my inadequate answer to that question.
Okay. I have an interesting, complete switch, I think, but an interesting question. This is a chat question, and it says, since no worthy villain experiences himself as a villain, paren, not even Richard III at his most melodramatic, and paren, how will writers of modern tragedy create sympathy for the public figure who has both betrayed his own and nullified society's core values?
Well, I would love to know a little bit more about where the question is coming from.
Yeah.
It's certainly true what the writer said. I think it was Socrates who said that nobody thinks they're doing evil, right? But it's also been remarked on by literary critics that when you make a character the protagonist of a fiction, they become sympathetic even when they're not sympathetic people at all. And there are various examples like Thackeray's Barry Lyndon or whomever. And I certainly think that's as paradoxical as that can seem while we're reading, that we're sort of being drawn willy-nilly into sympathy with someone whose actions we objectively despise, I think that ultimately it's one of the great things that literature does, because it forces us to see things from the point of view of people who we're inclined to demonize. We tend to demonize in our lives, and especially when we think politically, and literature forces us to be as sympathetic as possible. I mean, there certainly are outright villains who we're meant to despise. But the more I read, especially the more I reread the same books, the more I become sympathetic with people who I'm ultimately not supposed to like. So I don't know if that answered the question. I'd love to hear more about where it's coming from.
Alan, are you there? Alan?
Hello.
Hi. Did you hear Bill's answer to your question?
Yeah, I did. I thought I'd give him the provenance of the question if he wanted it.
Okay.
Sure.
Hello.
Yeah.
That was really tacked on to another question about politics and polarization in present American day politics. And
yeah.
In an Arnoldian sense of criticism as the criticism of life.
Right.
And when we have a politics in which we are so divided that the extreme right doesn't talk to anybody in the middle of the extreme left as well, how out of that will we get a readership that can somehow cross over away from its own point of view and accept or be able to consider somebody whom they really can't begin with to sympathize
right.
with until the reading comes in.
Right. Well, you may disagree, but I feel like it's not that we need to have a readership that's prepared to do that. I, I, I'm not a historian, but I doubt very much that this polarization of our politics is anything particularly new in human history.
No, I think that it's up to the writer to make the reader...
up to the writer, exactly.
To bring the reader into sympathy, of course.
Right, right. And when I would teach the Iliad, and, you know, you have this scene of Achilles and Priam sort of, mm-hmm. At the end, kind of communing with each other. And I would say, you know, I mean, it's easy for Priam as a sympathetic figure from the beginning, but I would say to my students, you know, you have to think of Priam as Osama bin Laden. You have to think of him as Saddam Hussein.
Uh-huh.
That's how the Greeks thought of him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Homer was able to show him as a fully sympathetic character and to show Achilles, you know, in this moment of kind of tragic communion where they recognize that they were all victims of the same processes that they can't control. So yeah, it's up to the writer. I would love to see somebody write the tragedy of George W. Bush. You know,
I would also, and another LBJ, Richard Nixon. You know, LBJ, we had way back Barbara Carson's McBird, but that was not a tragedy.
That was not a tragedy, right? No, I agree with you. I would love to see writers do that. I don't know if it's really on people's radar screens and.
Well, really, what I keep scratching my head about is how to get it onto people's radar screens. But I thank you. I agree with you. And by the way, I thought your piece on James Wood was marvelous.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Thanks for the question.
All right, we're going to go on to another phone call. I think the person from, let's see, area code 915. Are you there?
Yes.
Yes, hi.
Yes,
tell
I
us
am.
Your name and, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
William Springer, I'm calling from Redonza, New Mexico.
Hi, what's your question today?
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, William.
What's your question? Hello? You there? Oh, we must have lost him again. Okay.
I think we lost him.
Yep. All right, there, I have another chat question. This one, we have a... time for another question or two after this one. But this one is, earlier you mentioned that criticism should not be specialized and should be more accessible to all. In that vein, who, if anyone, do you have in mind when you write? And given your experience as a teacher, are you trying to inspire readers to read?
Well, the answer to the second question is easy. I'm absolutely trying to inspire readers to read and to think about what they're reading in ways that may not have occurred to them. That's what I love about the best criticism that I read. I mentioned the New York critics in the piece on James Wood, and they came up in this conversation. They're certainly people that I always come back to. I like to read the novelists who are good critics. I think Claire Massoud is a very fine critic. I think Virginia Woolf may be the best we've ever had. And there are still some academics who... Frank Kermode comes to mind. Even when he's writing for an academic audience, he has this marvelous ability to be extremely complex and extremely lucid at the same time. Quite frankly, I learn a lot every time I read James Wood. I mean, my criticism of him was intended to be a partial criticism. I think that, you know, there's some things he does great and some things that he doesn't do at all. And other people who are writing today. I could name other names, but I think that should give some indication of what I like to read in criticism. Okay?
I think that's about all the questions and all the time we have. Don, do you have any follow-up closing comments?
No, I don't. I think this has been a great, a very nice conversation.
Wait, hold on. I have one more question here. Hold on one second. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
No problem.
I'd love to take one more. Here we go.
Go ahead.
Hi, area code 212.
Hi.
Max?
Yes, hi. This is Max calling
hi.
From New York.
Question?
Hi, Bill. I'm a big fan of yours, but I've always wanted to ask you a question about a piece that you wrote, I think, 2 years ago for The Nation about the Yiddish Policemen's Union.
Oh yeah.
At the end of that, you said that perhaps the American Jewish experience was disappearing as a subject for fiction, or as a potential subject for fiction. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, and I don't know what the implications of that might be.
Right, sure, sure. Let me say that I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish community in North Jersey. My parents were immigrants. They spoke a lot of Yiddish to each other anyway when they didn't want us to understand. And I grew up with a lot of people, you know, a lot of the adults in the community were immigrants, refugees from the Holocaust, survivors. It was a kind of a total social environment. It's a kind of rich social environment with its own assumptions, its own manners, its own language that you could write a novel about. As Philip Roth's childhood was like, and the other great writers of the Jewish American experience. And my observation was simply, and this isn't really a criticism of anyone, it was just a historical observation, that because Jewish American assimilation has been so successful, the American Jewish experience is really just the American experience. I don't think that American Jews, by and large, except for the ones who are still Orthodox and certainly the ultra-Orthodox, I don't think that, by and large, they think or talk differently from other Americans with a similar socioeconomic background. And that's why my observation about the new American Jewish writing is that it's either not about Jews at all in particular, like Jonathan Lethem, or it's about Jews that are in some way more exotic than American Jews, like the Yiddish Policeman's Union, or the other book that was mentioned, that was discussed in the same review about the dirty war in Argentina, the Ministry of Special Cases, Nathan Englander's book. So I don't know if you agree with that, Max.
I don't think I disagree. I think I just, having grown up a big fan of Roth and Bellow and that world of writers, I guess I and a Jew growing up in New York, I miss that. And I wonder, I guess, where that kind of fictional, that kind of, shtetl, fictional narrative might be coming from today. Do you think new immigrant populations are generating that kind of stuff, something like Juno Diaz or something along
those lines? Yeah, I was going to say, the next review I wrote after that one was about Juno Diaz. Absolutely, yeah. There, you know, for better or for worse, I just don't think that there are a lot of Jewish... There are some people now who've come out of that modern Orthodox experience that I grew up with, who are beginning to write fiction about it. It may not be the kind of fiction that has the vitality of the old people yet. I think it's going to have to come from other groups by and large.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Thanks, Max.
Bill, do you have time for a few more questions?
Absolutely.
We had a
flurry
of activity here all of a sudden. So
I'd be happy to.
Great. Okay. This is a phone call from area code 215. Area code 215, are you there?
I'm here, right here.
Hi. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Jonathan Sternberg. I'm calling from Philadelphia. I'm Professor Emeritus Temple University College of Music, thus I'm a thorough outsider. But I'm not involved, I read literary criticism, usual publications from New York and perhaps elsewhere, and I'm appalled by what I read, not only with literary criticism, but with art and music criticism as well. And I find that the writers, to quote the New Yorker from many years ago, sound of own word department. They're more concerned about how they write and not with the content as much as how they sound. I find as well the number of critics throughout the country, if not internationally, literally quote from marketers who talk about their clients, and when they review books, they mention all the things which the marketers put in as award-winning, et cetera, about the author. I don't know if I'm alone in thinking this way, or maybe somebody now can help me.
Bill, John?
Well, I can say that I read a fair number of reviews myself, and while I do, it's obvious when writers are cribbing from
publicity release or even for maybe a Wikipedia entry listing someone's accomplishments. You know, I don't think everyone does that. I mean, people at the nation certainly don't. We make sure of that, but they wouldn't do so anyways. I think they're in it to talk about what's happening in the work. You know, if anything, if someone mentions an award or an accomplishment, it's kind of a bell for a lay reader who may be unacquainted with the work, but may have come across the author or musician's name in the newspaper, and you know they see, you know, the name of a prize and a bell of recognition goes off. So, you know, I think, yeah, I do see some of the problem that's being described, but I don't think we're drowning in it.
Right. I mean, if I mention stuff like that, usually near the beginning of review, just like you, exactly what John just said, to kind of remind people of where they may have heard this person before. And also, if I'm about to say something negative, I want to acknowledge that, you know, actually this book won a prize, but this is my this is my opinion. But I wonder, I mean, I don't know, I think John knows this sort of thing much better than I do, but I wonder if 30 or 50 years ago quite so much reviewing was done by other novelists. And like I said, I think that there's some novelists, I mean, I think they make the best critics if they're really serious critics, but I think it can also be kind of log rolling, you know, I'll review your book, you review mine, or not even, maybe it doesn't even work exactly like that, but a publisher or an agent might want the novelist to write reviews, and I think that there's a strong tendency in that case to kind of get along by going along. It happens in academia too, right? You don't want to rub anybody the wrong way. And that's why I think it's important to have full-time critics who are not just trying to get a good review for their next book by writing a good review of somebody else's.
There's always, log rolling always occurs. It's just, it's a hazard of the profession. But to respond to something Bill brought up about novelists writing criticism, I do think, you know, earlier in the century, maybe up to the 60s and 70s, there was more commerce, in all senses of the word, between people who wrote for little magazines and people who wrote for general interest magazines like The Nation. You know, you could find a novelist reviewing a novel in The Nation, and then also find that novelist reviewing something in Kenyon Review or some other literary quarterly. That happens much less frequently now, and I think, you know, there are all kinds of reasons for that, having to do with reward structures in higher education and this kind of academic journalistic split that's occurred, where, you know, each party thinks the other isn't as good as them. So, you know, but that is to say, novelists can't write for their publications. Peggy?
Okay. Yes, I'm still here. We're going to take one more question. I think we've got time for one more, and it's a chat question. It's from someone named John Darger, and I'll read it to you. David Foster Wallace's suicide was, of course, disappointing for those of us who loved his writing. He said in one interview where he was talking along with Jonathan Franzen that it wasn't possible to write the Dostoevsky novel anymore. I had rejected his contention and still had hoped that he might pull together some great synthetic novel that would generate a larger audience and use his incredible linguistic skills toward a great social purpose. I worried that he found that fact and the implicit expectation of people like me that he might still do that overwhelming. Do you think the kind of broad novel that he was talking about is still possible? And what role does criticism play in its possibility, if so?
Wow. That's a really big question, too.
That's quite a last question.
Yeah. I think DeLillo and Pynchon have been trying to write that kind of novel. I guess one answer is to say that American society has become too complicated and maybe in many ways too opaque for that to be possible. And maybe also, you know, I'm not sure that novel was ever written in America. I mean, people have been trying to write the great American novel for, you know, ever since there's been America and a novel. Maybe it was Moby Dick. Maybe it was written a long time ago. I'm not really sure that the novel that can encompass I don't know. I mean, I think Dostoevsky was writing in a country that was a little easier to get a handle on, even though it was Russia. I mean, it not only had a much more easily defined political and social center in Petersburg and Moscow, but it also had a much more clearly defined ideological center in the Orthodox Church, and maybe the various radical ideologies that were contending against it. I mean, what would you write about if you were writing the great American Dostoevskian or Dickensian novel? I mean, I think people like Wallace have been struggling with that for a long time. I think that fiction is the only medium that can do it. I mean, it's not enough to say, well, the creative energies are going more towards film and video, because I'm not sure that they have the scope to tackle it. What role criticism can play in helping bring that about? You know, I'm very wary of critics, you know, who issue calls for a certain kind of fiction. I always think that that's incredibly pretentious and presumptuous. I think the role of the critic is to say to writers what Cocteau is supposed to have said, what Diaghilev is supposed to have said to Cocteau, astonish me. I think that that's all we can really say, and be receptive when new work appears that challenges our own conceptions about what great art should be. I'm not sure what else we can do, but I have to think about it. John?
I want to get back to the first part of the question, which is I think there are some novelists, and some of them are novelists whose work Bill has written about, who have been trying to tackle the big questions and have been successful to the degree that they've astonished us, but we perhaps misperceive or miscategorize what they're doing because it's not advertised as a great American novel. And the name that springs to mind is Marilynne Robinson, a novelist who Bill reviewed her last novel for us. And I think in her work you see this very quintessential American dilemma, which is both frightening and very rich. And it's this collision between a sense of existential homelessness and history on the one hand and religion on the other, and how those three modes of being in the world have shaped each other and collided over the course of American history. I mean, it happens to be that Robinson's novels are all set in domestic spaces, and maybe that's why they're misperceived as not being as ambitious creatively as, say, a David Foster Wallace or even a Melville. Bill, what do you think?
I think that that's a great point. I hadn't thought about it this way. I wish you wrote more reviews, John.
Well,
I think that's a great idea.
I'm editing, so there you go.
Okay.
But I think, you know, greatness doesn't necessarily mean big, and it's often been the case that women who are novelists they're on to these dilemmas, but they happen on a different scale. Just because they're
right.
on a different scale doesn't mean they're not grand. They're
right.
just or diminished. It's just, you know, it's its own sense of scale, and one has to learn to appreciate that.
I think that that's a great point.
Peggy?
Next Dostoevsky isn't going to look like Dostoevsky, and we have to be prepared to recognize that.
Bill and John, John Darger, who asked that question, is on the phone, so I'm assuming he has a closing question comment. John, are you there?
I am.
Hi, John.
How are you doing? I tuned in late. I wanted to say that I'm really glad that Bill is writing for The Nation. I really admire Stuart Clowen's film criticism, and I'm hoping that we can have criticism happening in The Nation like that. The Clowen's review that really blew me away or sort of, you know, drew me to his work was the review of American Beauty, which is, I think, a great film. But Clowen's put it in a larger perspective against Sunset Boulevard, which he said had a social context to it, that where you saw the story that was being told in the frame of the society. And so I guess my question was, I am, you know, really depressed that David Foster Wallace didn't do what I had hoped that he would do, and I am going to read Marilynne Robinson, but I just wanted to, you know, add my hope that we will have great criticism. I used to admire the criticism in the New Republic, which really, really sort of went to the dark side after 9/11. And so I've missed, I dropped my subscription to that journal, and I've missed, and I don't think the New York Times does good book criticism. Oftentimes it's very commercial, and the sort of log rolling kind of stuff. But I'm excited about the possibilities of criticism of the Nation. I just wanted to add that.
Well, thank you. Well, we're still here, so we'll continue.
Well, and let me say, if I can just say quickly, that I agree with what with what John was implicitly saying, that and this is what I was trying to say in the James Wood piece, that what the New York critics were doing was to place literature not only in its own history, but in the larger social and cultural and intellectual history, to see the work within the largest possible framework. And now I realize that maybe I'm wrong, that, you know, what can critics do to help bring about the next Dostoevsky? Maybe what we can do, and I try to do this in my own, you know, small way, is to try to bring that context to bear on the works that we talk about, so that maybe writers and readers get the idea that what they should be doing is not simply, you know, rendering the domestic situation or the romantic situation or whatever it is that they think they should be writing about, but trying to think in the largest historical and cultural and social terms. You know, what are the forces that are creating this situation, and how can I bring those to the page? So.
All right, I think that's all we have time for today. John, do you have any closing comments?
Nothing except that this is I'm very grateful for everyone who's phoned in or written in a question. I think it's been a very, very rich conversation.
I agree. I'm really glad for the opportunity to have done this. Thank you.
It's the first call that we've done related to the books in the arts section, and I can guarantee it won't be the last. This has been terrific, and thanks so much to everybody who called in. We do these conference calls every month or two, and it's exclusive to our Nation Associates programs. You need to be a member of our Nation Associates, and we need to have your email for you to be invited on these calls. But they've been a huge success, and I can guarantee that we'll have many more down the line. And thanks so much to you, Bill, and also to you, John, for joining us today. If anybody who called in has any questions or comments, or we didn't get to a question that you might have wanted to ask, just send us an email at rsvp@thenation.com, and we'll get it and read it and respond. Thanks so much. We'll hope to see you all again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.